From Tel Aviv, Israel, I'm Suzek Rolat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. This week, Rebecca Cruz rejoins us as we have been traveling through Jordan and Israel. The two of us will share our impressions of these two very distinct countries.
A lot is going on here, and they really are flourishing. And in many ways, it feels like a Western or European city, whereas Amman really did feel quite a bit different.
And I'll talk with NPR's senior strategist for social media, Andy Carvin, about using Twitter to cover revolutions in the Middle East.
They would even do things such as look at the weather forecast or where the moon is supposed to be in the sky, compare that to the footage to see if that matched up.
He's the author of Distant Witness, Social Media, the Arab Spring, and a Journalism Revolution. These conversations coming up after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. There's an awful lot in the international news this week. A lot of flooding across Europe, particularly Central Europe. Protests, of course, continue in Turkey, and now there are protests at the G8 summit in the UK. But I sit here in Tel Aviv, Israel, with Rebecca Cruz. Rebecca, welcome back to the roundtable.
Shalom, Suzek. Good to be here.
So here we are in an extremely modern city, Tel Aviv, after having spent several days in Jordan, actually, a couple of days in Israel. But first, let's talk about Jordan and our impressions of that country. Jordan seems to be kind of a beacon of stability in the Middle East, but it remains in a very complicated neighborhood. I mean, we actually visited a site in the northern part of Jordan where we stood at this crossroads where we looked to the north and we were 3 hours from Damascus, Syria. And we looked to the east and we were 3 hours from Baghdad, Iraq. And we looked to the south and we were 5 hours from the border of Saudi Arabia. And we looked to the east and we were 2 to 3 hours from the West Bank of Israel. I mean, what a complicated place to be. What did you think about Jordan?
Yeah, I agree with you. Jordan was a very interesting experience. I mean, obviously it was deserty, very dry, and I think that was very stark to us. But thinking about its geography, as you mentioned, it's kind of become the stable place in the region. And because of this, they've actually taken on a number of refugees. We've talked about that in the Syrian case. But they've been taking refugees for the last 20 years or so. They took some during the Iraqi situations.
Well, even longer than that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a tremendous amount of Palestinians in the country after the Palestinian-Israeli conflict began. I mean, they've got refugees from Iraq. They've got refugees now from Syria. I mean, we went to visit a Syrian refugee camp at Za'atari in the north. I mean, good heavens, what an amazing sight.
Yeah, this is one of the largest refugee camps that they're taking Syrian refugees. We're talking about over 100,000 people. And although we didn't get full access, we were there seeing some of the new arrivals. And this was really quite heartbreaking, really, to see these people come in. They had their life's belongings in a wheelbarrow. And really, they looked like they were, looking for the rescue that was coming. And of course, we know that these refugee camps are not always the best places, that they're going to be entering these locations where there are a lot of tents. We could see this from a great distance, hundreds upon hundreds of tents, very difficult circumstances, very dry. We saw dust devils all over the place. It was a very stark landscape out there. And who knows how long they're going to be in these circumstances. So they were coming in with some hope, and unfortunately, I don't know how hopeful the situation really is going to be for them. So that was very sad to see.
It was absolutely heartbreaking to see just as far as the eye could see, as you said, tents, some thousands and thousands really of refugee tents and the people, coming in the gates with all of their earthly belongings in wheelbarrows. And it was just absolutely incredible to see and very sad because they don't know what is going to happen next. And here they are in a situation where they really have nowhere else to go. It was really a remarkable sight. But now here we are in Israel, Tel Aviv. We flew 45 minutes from Amman, Jordan to Tel Aviv, Israel. And what a different planet we are in. Tel Aviv, Israel, really a very modern country. I mean, this is amazing. We're sitting here at the seaside. It's an incredible city. We visited Haifa. We visited today Jerusalem. I mean, it's a completely different place, but yet still a very complex place. We've talked to a lot of people about the Palestinian plight, the West Bank. We drove through the West Bank today. Obviously Gaza is troubling down in the south. So, but yet, Israel seems to be stable. There's a tremendous amount of coexistence. What are your impressions, Rekha?
Well, who would have thought a couple years ago that the two stable countries in the region would be Jordan and Israel, the two that we were able to visit? I'll be honest with you, I wasn't really sure what to expect in coming here, but you're right. It's been completely different, I think, than what I had in mind. This is a very beautiful country and really very lush vegetation, and as opposed to the desert that we saw primarily in Jordan. And there are some very dry areas here, but it's been very different. As you mentioned, the cities, there is a serious security concern. We've talked about this. Israel has really been in a war-type situation throughout its very short history, about every 8 years. So there is a serious security concern. And yet life goes on. We've seen people out in the streets. We see quite a bit of tourism, perhaps a little dropped off here in the last couple of years due to the turmoil in the region. But a lot is going on here, and they really are flourishing. And in many ways, it feels like a Western or European city, whereas as Amman really did feel quite a bit different.
I mean, Israel, just the geography, just the access to the water. I mean, we heard in Jordan about, the Jordan River being dammed up, and of course all the water being taken by Israel, and that there's not a thing the Jordanians can do about it. I mean, you can see it. You can see the evidence here of water being used in Israel and not really being available to Jordan downriver. But it's really an incredibly remarkable place. But I think the thing that was most promising to me, as we visited various cities in Israel and even in Jerusalem, is that it's really incredibly diverse. The universities we've visited have, Arab students and Israeli students and European students, Asian students, American students. I mean, students from all around the world that are working together and that are studying together. And it's, I think, if we can be hopeful at all, it's in that the young people in this part of the world are actually coming together and perhaps can provide us some, hopeful future to look forward to.
Yeah, we certainly saw that today when we went to Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and perhaps even a little bit more so when we went to Haifa, a city here in Israel that's really known for having had this cultural diversity that hasn't necessarily been caught up in some of the difficulties that other parts of Israel have faced. We went to the campus there, really both campuses, and saw people of different faiths, different ethnicities, obviously different religions, working together, eating together, communicating together. So that was really positive. And I would also add that, in Jordan, we were able to visit with universities. And these were, in some instances, very conservative universities. People were, wearing their religious garments and that sort of thing. But everyone was very friendly to us. Everyone was very curious, very interested, and very excited to talk with us, or at least to wave to us and say hello. So that was a nice feeling, and it does give you some sense of hope.
I think that's been the real takeaway that I have from the Middle East, and that includes Turkey and Jordan and Israel, and that is just the really friendly nature of the people from this part of the planet, and how welcoming they are, and how happy they've been that we're here. We're here to learn about them and study their culture and share that information. So, well, Rebecca, welcome back. It's been a long several weeks of traveling for you. I know you'll be in the United States back home next week, and I'm on to Italy, where you started your venture. So until next week, thank you very much, as always, for your insight.
Thank you, Suzette.
This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Rolat. My guest today is Andy Carvin. He's a senior strategist at NPR who leads experimental social media efforts as a sort of journalistic test pilot. In 2011, The Guardian newspaper in Britain called him the man who tweets revolutions for his 18-hour-a-day, 7-days-a-week live coverage of the Arab Spring. His new book, Distant Witness, offers a first-person recap of those efforts and documents intimate stories of the revolutions that would never have been recorded before the days of social media. Andy Carvin, welcome to Worldviews.
Thanks for having me.
So I've been following your work, and your position at NPR. I think it's interesting that you're listed as a strategist, and you refer to yourself actually as an informational guru on your Twitter bio.
Oh, no. I refer to myself, I jokingly call myself an informational DJ, and I ask
informational DJ.
And I ask people not to call me a guru.
A guru, that's right. An informational DJ. That's even more interesting, actually. But could you tell us, what does this mean, and how does strategically processing information, especially information that you're gathering via the internet and social media, how is that a form of journalism?
Well, my actual title is senior strategist, and it's always been intended to confound people somewhat, simply because the type of work that I do has never existed in a newsroom prior to a few years ago. What I do is a combination of acting as a reporter and a producer and editor, but I also work with our production people and our business development people. And so historically, there wasn't a place in a newsroom hierarchy or an organizational chart where I would naturally fit. And so that's why I chose a title such as that. But, I mean, the work that I actually do is I spend a lot of my time using social media to identify breaking news stories, as well as to find stories of people who are experiencing amazing things around the world. A lot of my time over the last couple of years really specifically focused on the Arab Spring. But I've also used these methods to cover earthquakes and political events and elections and the like. And so,
and shootings in the United States, even. You were covering Newtown.
Yeah, a few times I've had to do that as well.
My guest today is Andy Carvin, a senior strategist for social media at NPR and the author of Distant Witness, Social Media, the Arab Spring, and a Journalism Revolution. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm talking with NPR's Senior Strategist for Social Media, Andy Carvin. When we left off, he described how he uses Twitter to identify both breaking news and stories of people experiencing amazing things around the world. We were having trouble with our Skype connection, so during the break, we called him back on a landline. So this method that you use, as you refer to it, it's kind of come to be known as what you call crowdsourcing, right? Can you explain what this means and how it is an effective way to get at the truth, if you will?
Well, crowdsourcing is basically just a fancy term for asking for help from the public. It's something journalists have always done at various points, but now social media has made it easy to engage people all over the world when you're asking for help on different things you're trying to cover. So, for example, when the first video started coming out of Libya in early 2011, my Twitter followers helped me identify local dialects to make sure that it was actually from somewhere in Libya. They would look for landmarks in the background and help me find them on Google Maps. They would even do things such as look at the weather forecast or where the moon is supposed to be in the sky and compare that to the footage to see if that matched up. And so all these people would come out of the woodwork offering different skills, and collectively we'd be able to work together and sort out what was true and what wasn't.
Well, this interesting story that you're telling us now is obviously presented in your book, Distant Witness, and I read that book with much interest. Can you tell us a little bit more about your experience during covering the revolutions during the Arab Spring and kind of what some of the most compelling stories you faced and how it had an impact on the work that you were doing there?
Well, it's interesting when you go into a story not realizing that you're actually going to be covering it, and then all of a sudden finding yourself covering half a dozen revolutions simultaneously. There was a lot going on at once, but there were definitely people who stood out at different times. In Libya, there was a young man named Mohamed Nabous who managed to jerry-rig a satellite connection for internet access in the city of Benghazi. And while Gaddafi's forces were essentially massacring protesters, he was able to keep this internet connection up and running while the opposition retook the city from Gaddafi and held on to it up until the point where NATO intervened. And over the course of that month, he spent sometimes upwards of 20 hours a day using his live stream to document what was going on with countless volunteers, translating what he was finding out in multiple languages. And then in other places, you had people like a woman in Bahrain who goes by the Twitter handle Angry Arabia. She comes from a family of human rights activists and dissidents. And in the first month of the protests in Bahrain, almost her entire immediate family was jailed. Her father's been sentenced to life in prison. Her husband was in jail. Her brother-in-law was in jail. And she's been in and out of jail at least half a dozen times over the last 2 years. And she's documented all of this through Twitter. And while you've been able to follow her story over Twitter, her opponents who are within the government or just government supporters also use social media to attack her and attack her cause. So you see the political fights playing out online the same way they do offline.
So as you're going about observing these things and watching from a distance, right? I mean, you're looking at all of this, you're reading about all of these things on social media, and watching this play out and telling us and reporting back to us, those of us who are watching what you're watching, telling us the news. Actually, one of our listeners asked an interesting question when we tweeted out that we were going to be interviewing you, and she wanted to know kind of what your best practice is for crediting these participants. So when you're reading about all of these people that are tweeting these stories, and then you retweet them and you're telling us what's going on, I mean, what's kind of the best practice for that? How do you incorporate them into that story and kind of, I guess, isolate them from the crowd source?
Well, ideally, when a news event is breaking out, it's always helpful to know at least one person on the ground. So, for example, in the case of Egypt, I knew one particular blogger who had been active in protests online and offline for a number of years. And so I went to his Twitter account and took a look at who were the very first people he decided to follow when he joined Twitter. And I then started following those people and did the same thing with them. Over a few days, I watched them talk among themselves and got a sense of who was related to whom, who was working together with whom, and what their roles were. And so as the protests really kicked into high gear, I had this pool of many dozens of people who were on the ground in Tahrir Square documenting what was going on. In other circumstances, when you don't necessarily know someone that's on the ground, you can do things such as do geographic searches on Twitter so it only shows you results for people within a certain radius. So, for example, in the aftermath of the Newtown shootings in Connecticut, I set up a Twitter search for a five-mile radius around Newtown, and I saw tweets from people who were rushing to pick up their kids from school or were rushing to the hospital because they were worried a relative had been shot or even students who were in lockdown in their classrooms at other schools around the area. And so, and all of this is coming in real time, and often in some stories you're able to get wind of it before it's being widely covered, and you can, when you do these types of searches, you can look at the timestamps of what people have been tweeting and seeing if their timestamps precede anything the media has reported on it.
Well, as you mentioned at the outset, this is obviously kind of a new form of media that your job, doing things like this, wasn't something that we used to do before this kind of method, this kind of social media. But let me ask you, is it possible at all that this kind of real-time news sharing, as you refer to it, this real-time sharing of information via Twitter and other forms of social media, is it possible at all that this kind of leads to certain snap judgments about what's going on rather than reasoned analysis? Or is this just, in other words, is it a better form of journalism? Is it just a different form of journalism? What is kind of the final analysis about this method that you're using?
Well, I think it depends on what you want to compare it to. I think if you compare it to the 24-hour news cycle that exists within cable news, I would argue that there are actually sometimes more risks involved in that type of coverage because you're not allowed to have dead air. If you run out of things to say, you need to quickly find someone else to start talking. And when you've got that kind of nonstop coverage, there's a decent chance that you're going to make mistakes. Whereas, ironically, on Twitter, if you want to slow down, you can slow things down. Or if you want to raise questions about something someone is reporting, or have one of your Twitter followers challenge your own reporting, those interactions can happen right there in real time at their own pace. And so I think when it comes to social media, there are certain checks and balances that can exist if you've got the right community of people working with you, and you don't have that problem of dead air that is always being filled with information during a live broadcast. And so it has its strengths and it has its challenges, but no more so than in any other format.
Well, one last thing for you, Andy. This is such an interesting phenomenon that we're experiencing today. Although, you know, it's been the fact that the internet has really changed the way in which not only we gather and share the news, but it also has an impact on movements. And so as you've witnessed in the Arab Spring in countries like Egypt and elsewhere, where, you know, social media really had an impact on the revolutions themselves. So have you found that that's actually the case in all cases? So, I mean, for example, like Syria, you know, is it making an impact in Syria differently than it's making an impact in Egypt? And what do you think might explain the difference, if there is one?
Well, I think the key word there is the differences, because every country has been different. In some cases, it's had to do with how readily available internet access is. So internet access is much more common in a place like Bahrain or Tunisia than it is, let's say, in Libya or in Yemen. And so you don't see as much online organizing going on in some of those countries. In the case of Egypt, you also had a lot of reporters who were based in Cairo. And we had a bit of lead time because it happened just after the Tunisian Revolution, and there was a 10-day break between the two. And so it was possible to get a lot of reporters in place to cover it there. Whereas in Syria started very slowly and somewhat quietly, and then sort of increased at a drip, drip, drip kind of rate until suddenly we find ourselves in a situation where first 5 or 10 people are getting killed a day, then 20 or 30, and now, you know, 100 to 200 people are killed a day. And it's just been a very different type of conflict because it's become this war of attrition that just keeps going and going and going. And many citizen journalists, if you will, have lost their lives trying to document what's going on in cities across Syria. And while I think this their coverage has raised the profile of Syria around the world, I think one could also argue that it hasn't necessarily impacted the policy-making decisions that have been made about Syria.
Well, Andy Carvin, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your perspectives on this issue with us today on Worldviews.
Thanks. Good talking to you.
You've been listening to my conversation with NPR's senior strategist for social media, Andy Carvin. You can read an excerpt of his book, Distant Witness, by visiting our website at kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaboration between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview, Brian Hardzinski produces and edits the show, and our digital content intern for the summer is Hallie Arias. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzak Rilat.